You are listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture. This is issue number 8, talking about my generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. I'm Tim Cox, the guest editor and narrator for the issue. To conclude our series of 10 thematic episodes, we will hear from this generation about practice, from their individual offices to the profession writ large. Our conversations were primarily framed in the negative, around the question of why this generation has produced so few built projects. Whether real or perceived, respondents saw their ability to produce meaningful architecture as more limited than prior generations of academic architects. Their explanations for why this was the case ranged from a need for more time, to difficulties finding clients, the need to have experience in practice to be able to win RFPs, the barriers to entry in the American profession, or the monopolistic qualities of huge, 1,000-person firms with offices across the country. The most convincing trend that explains this generation's struggle to build was a widening gap between academia and practice. All the respondents are successful architecture academics, many of them with positions at Ivy League schools and countless awards from architectural institutions. However, recognition from the Architecture League and a position at Princeton seems not to translate to opportunities for meaningful built work. The antagonisms between academia and practice will be a running theme throughout this episode, and we will ultimately question what relationship academics can have with practice in our specific historical context. To begin, we will hear from Anna Niemark, Michelle Chang, and Kyle Reynolds, who all described the desire to build more.
I look at these names and I think, like, wow, it's an incredible group of people. But then, can we count how many buildings we've all put out there into this world? Count them on our fingers, probably.
It's so frustrating to love so many buildings and not be able to build them. Looking at the plaza's construction book, Burghauser detail, just loving that stuff. And then getting to the point where you're trying to find a builder and then just things are too crazy in terms of their exactitude, you know, just like lining things up or their budgets.
We haven't figured it out yet. It's something that's very desirable for us to do, is to build, is to test these ideas in the real world, so to speak, but just haven't figured out how to kind of make that connection.
Since this generation has spent so much of their career in the academy, it's difficult to learn the skills and build the networks necessary to have a successful building practice. The career paths that lead to success in the academy versus success in practice vary wildly, and not all expertise is transferable between the two. Paul Preisner and Stuart Hicks both described how choosing an academic path pushed them away from practice.
Everybody wants to practice much more than they can, but they cannot. So then you have to teach. And then you're in an environment where your production is different than were you just designing buildings. And so you shift how you practice and what you produce, which then some way limits your ability to get projects in a weird way too, right?
The expectation that you can be an architect and a professor at a younger and younger age, there's also a pressure to constantly produce and have yourself be visible. It takes a long time to learn how to make a building and how to get clients. And that doesn't lend itself to putting in a decade at a great firm, striking it out on your own. Like, that's a slow process. And once you're a decade out of school, it's pretty hard to get an academic position. So like if you're a decade out of school, you work for Herzog de Meuron, you start your own practice, it's going to take you 5 years, probably at least, before you would build up a portfolio where a school would bring you in to be a teacher, unless you had other connections, which you probably would. But it would take time to kind of build it up from there. If you maintain those connections from grad school and you start right away, you're already kind of immersed in the world of academia and you never left. So you're able to start right away, but that means you don't get those practice skills. Coupled with the fact that you're constantly need to produce things that are publishable, and architecture doesn't operate on that timeline. So you're doing competitions, you're doing things that are quick, you're writing, you're doing things that can be seen. And to find success in those things doesn't necessarily point you in the direction of building something.
Mira Henry seemed to corroborate this diagnosis, that those with careers in academia will necessarily have far fewer built projects. She suggested curating a different group of people for a conversation about practice and building.
You've only asked people who are teachers on the list. It's pretty narrow. I would turn that around a little bit, and I think that there are plenty of individuals one could begin to have this conversation with who don't fundamentally spend the most of their time teaching.
However, this generation frequently mentioned crafting a closer relationship to practice and closing the gap between academic and professional work. Aesthetically, they discussed favoring vernacular forms, Home Depot material palettes, and simple construction methods in order to keep their design output cheap, relatable to the public, and imminently buildable. This generation shares a collective desire to build, and despite choosing an academic path, they tailored their work to address the realities of practice. Here's Michael Young.
Every single one of these people on this list wants to do buildings. So this is a little different than other moments in time when you'll find the experimental avant-garde within architecture being clearly against the building realm. I don't think anyone on this list would tell you, no, I don't want to do buildings. I only want to do drawings. I only want to do fantasies. I only want to do those kinds of digital experiments. I don't think you'll find a single person on this list that will say that. So everybody here wants to do buildings. So everybody here is at some level invested in a kind of possibility and the practicality of the ways in which their architecture can communicate. And that tends to do things like simplifies some of the formal experiments, simplifies some of the geometry, creates greater reference to some of the modes in which buildings and construction can typically be thought through and understood in their everyday built reality. But also, I think that every single one of these people would not represent their projects within an aesthetic language that is commercial realism. All of them would use some level of abstraction or graphic or link to different various experiments within the arts to distance the aesthetics of their representations from the photoreal.
Next, we will turn towards the current landscape of practice in the United States. The respondents understood their relationship to practice as uniquely American. They characterized America as having both a public who is uninterested in architecture that's informed by academic discourse, and a profession with a high barrier of entry. These factors contribute to a building culture that leans conservative and mild. In contrast, American schools of architecture were seen as powerhouses of discourse and experimentation within the context of global architectural culture. These cultural, economic, and institutional conditions vary dramatically from other countries like Switzerland, where architecture has far more public support, or places like Spain, where public competitions make the profession more accessible to young architects. Here are David Eskenazi, Michael Meredith, Kyle Reynolds, and Anani Mark.
The bigger difficulty is how hard it is to build in the United States anything that's of any architectural value. It's increasingly more and more difficult. And I think it's easy to look at the US and be like, oh, it's so academic and you know they're barely building anything and the stuff they build isn't that good. And I actually think those are two separate things, why it's so hard to build anything and why we have the academic model.
I do appreciate the kind of self-consciousness of the field in America. At the same time, I am always jealous, let's say, other models.
The way that American media treats design is very different than the types of discussions that are happening in some of these academic circles. So like what people get from Instagram or HGTV or any of the other formats that they might be absorbing design information from presents a completely different model and world than some of the things that interest this group.
If I were looking at the United States from outside of our context, I think we're a bunch of children playing games. I'd call it a bunch of bullshit, basically. Because in a world where architecture is valued, architects build a lot, and those buildings are really beautiful. I mean, we see so much beautiful work coming out of other countries, be it Mexico or Chile or France or Switzerland or Japan. Others now emerging as well. But in the United States, we don't value architecture. It's a kind of social crisis, I would say. I mean, fuck the disciplinary crisis. We have a kind of cultural crisis in this country. We have a country that's values money for the most part. And so we, as architects, don't build stuff. It's really insane.
Mira Henry and Niram Turan spoke about how difficult it is for young architects to enter practice in the U.S. when compared to other countries.
You know, Matthew and I speak a lot about different economies outside of the United States and ways in which government supports the building of architecture as a fundamental aspect of society, and that not being part of the American economy was certainly not trickling down to emerging practices. It just doesn't exist here as it does in some other examples of other economies.
United States, the way that practice and construction is constituted is very rigid, both in the way that regulations are organized. For a young practice to be able to test out and be ingrained in the nitty-gritties of practice is very difficult for many reasons. And usually the idea of experimentation, maybe naively through the idea of form, can only be done much more easily for practices who are bigger, who are trusted by developers or others, that they are actually maybe the ones who can. If you look at practices, young practices, the kinds of work they produce and the agency they have to create difference is very limited. Beyond the publications and exhibitions and installations, that world is, you know, great. Commissioning-wise, like in terms of the cycle of commissioning, because we don't have that competition cycle that most countries have, it doesn't distribute, let's say, opportunity equally. That it's always this, like, your parents, you know, blah, blah, blah.
This cohort also saw the circumstances of practice as specific to their generation. They reflected on how prior groups of academic architects taught and practiced in economic and institutional environments that allowed them to produce more built work. A common explanation for the success of previous generations was their strategy of building up cultural capital through exhibitions and publications before cashing out with major commissions. For example, figures like Stephen Hall or Bernard Schumi were able to secure clients for career catapulting projects off of portfolios of architectural representations turned art objects, like paintings. Clients now seem less interested in working with disciplinary experts who are novices in practice. Here are Jerome Hafford, Kyle Reynolds, Stuart Hicks, and Hans Tersak.
It was so interesting working for Bernard Schumi for 7 years. But I remember we were looking at some of his archive one day, and I think it was the Kansai Airport competition. I literally don't know if he had built anything and was being invited as an office to compete, paid very well, for airports and train stations around the world. We are not being asked to do those things. You know, at best, we're maybe being asked to do those as part of larger teams. There's a lot of things contributing to that difference. The way that the gatekeeping and the decision-making and the mitigation of risk is done in today's larger built environment.
Those days have passed. We certainly aren't operating that way. I remember seeing a Stanley Tigerman lecture at UIC in which he talked about a house. I think it was like the Daisy House or something like that, where, you know, he was presenting his work at a lecture to an architecture school. And then a client just kind of emerged out of the audience afterwards and asked him to build a house. And like, could you imagine that happening today to anyone, right? Seems kind of foreign to the system at the moment.
At least personally, there weren't clients coming to us because we won competitions.
We're talking about the generation above mine. They probably also built more. The idea that you might have a modest practice in, let's say, New York, if we're talking about Northeastern academia, or Los Angeles, for example, or Chicago, or Houston, whatever. You might have a modest practice. You might make a few houses a year. You also publish articles. You also teach. My generation is more likely to replace the output that would be having a practice that is a small business with licensed principal with something that is more physically wedded to the architecture building. So maybe we use the robots, or we get academic grants, or we work with precarious teams that assemble quickly, dissolve quickly, and reassemble quickly in different aggregations between a couple of universities, maybe. And our project is a pavilion or a material study that might have some corporate sponsorship in the mixture of academic grants, a little bit of corporate sponsorship. That's like replacing us doing single family homes, you know, for example, or apartment renovations as our design output. I don't mean to make a value judgment about either of those models. I just think one seems to be more prevalent than the other in the sort of generational divide.
In line with Tursak's observation that this group is generationally defined by its production of installations and gallery work, we heard Ashley Bingham and Daniel Jacobs argue positively for these more academic categories of work. They specifically saw these types of work as relevant today because they exist in a context where meaningful built practice is difficult.
I also wonder if the practice, the way that the profession operates, has also changed. It's just changed, say, the type of work that is accessible to practices like ours, younger practices, not directly within a very specific particular location or class of clients. Again, I don't know if that's the same as the 1970s. It's not paper architecture that we're doing now, but you see some architects not removing themselves from the world, but engaging the world in different ways, whether it be digitally, through media, through images, through film, through, you know, all kinds of things. But I wouldn't say that that's a lesser practice in any way. I think that's an incredibly powerful type of practice. We also can't overlook the fact that that is a successful way of practicing today because the political, social, economic system of the U.S. that we currently live in, where capital is so condensed in particular places with particular people that it's very hard, I think, for a young architect starting out to identify and work with clients in the way that a previous generation did, as in a kind of patron model.
Buildings are significantly more complex. There are fewer open platforms for young practitioners to be able to build something, hence the extreme focus on something like Ragdale or PS1, right, as the kind of generator of the contemporary cohort of architectural producers. But also, I think there is a thread of people who say there's kind of an impossibility of doing both, and not that that impossibility is the reason why you don't want to focus on buildings, but that actually the space of the exhibition and the space of the production of a project without construction of that project is just as rich and is just as attentive to the needs of our society and our collective conversation, that it's better to not be bedfellows with the neoliberal agendas of construction that are really difficult to work with and actually express a project that you see as important.
Michael Meredith also observed that the projects that were being discussed in academia were smaller scale than in the past. Instead of thinking at the scale of the city or even the skyscraper, architects were thinking about ADUs and furniture.
The attention has shifted away from these Cool House, Herzog de Meuron, whatever, these huge architects, towards smaller offices and smaller projects seem to be more approachable and more human. But I just feel like there's more attention being paid to these smaller things at the moment than these huge, massive projects that I think at one point was the dominant subject, kind of internalized urbanism or something in a building. So now it's like, yeah, playgrounds or wobbly objects or whatever it is, small houses even, or additions to something, which those would not have been on the radar previously.
As we've heard so far, this generation was invested in producing built work, but saw the profession in the US as challenging to break into as a young, inexperienced architect. They saw the practice of architecture as in crisis. From difficulty finding clients without a network of high-income contacts from family connections, to NCARB's many bureaucratic hoops, or the ever-expanding reach of huge, multinational architecture firms, making a meaningful contribution to the built environment felt increasingly out of reach. Underpinning these hurdles was a feeling that the status of the architect as a cultural actor was increasingly irrelevant. Architecture's cultural value was difficult to convey, and even harder to actually imbue in new construction. Here are Paul Preisner and Joffre Kolb.
Architecture is just not as able or nimble to respond to cultural things so much. So it ends up, in some ways, then having to always work with a much more steady cultural scaffold than it does following any particular change that might happen. But also, I think architecture is far more influenced by capital and the world that it's in than other forms of art. And it's a little bit less able to actually push back on culture that other forms of practice can.
I think that the profession of architecture is absolutely in crisis. You know, even just through Evie and my work, I feel like we constantly run up against clients being like, do we really need architects? Like, why are we paying you $100,000? You know, I think I can just go talk to the contractor and they'll just build the thing I want and they'll do it right and they'll probably figure out how to file it and they'll find some anonymous person who will stamp the drawing. And the whole thing, architecture just gets shunted. You know, it gets swept under the carpet amidst a series of other actors who can do our jobs faster, better, cheaper, and with less egoism than the way that we were taught to do it.
Members of this generation described finding a client as incredibly difficult, with the quality of one's academic work not corresponding to success with commissions. While they use the language of clients, we might understand their goal as finding a patron more specifically, someone who will fund work that also respects and understands their architectural perspective. For those with wealthy families, this can be a family member or family friend. The trope of architects building a house for their mother is so well known that Paul Anderson of Independent Architecture, who would have been at home within this interview series, called his first ground-up residence Mother House, as a cheeky nod to the most obvious funding source for a young practice. But for those who don't have personal connections to wealth, it was difficult to convince potential clients to buy into their design ideas. Jerome Hafford, Clark Thenhouse, and Paul Preisner all discussed the difficulty in getting work as an inexperienced architect.
As with any case, you still got to have the right client who respects you, who you can develop a relationship with, who will take a chance on your ideas. There's not always a taste level or a budget to do some of the things that we're drawing in our practices. But that's where some of these different aesthetics also, again, come back and have very real implications. So I don't think you need a high budget to do good work. But yeah, you do need someone who's willing to take a chance. And whether that's a community or a single person, that's the tricky part.
When I was younger, not that much younger though, a lot of questions from a potential client would always be about, I mean, I've been asked like how old I am, like do I own my own house? You know, questions like that, because people want to know who they're paying a lot of money, not a lot, they're paying money to for a huge budget project, right? Or a large budget project, hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, and that's a lot of money.
For most young practices, you get work if you grew up wealthy with connected parents and they can start funneling work your way. Otherwise, how do you get work? Because architecture is expensive, and if you don't know clients, you won't get them.
This generation saw the licensure process, administered by NCARB, as another barrier to entry into the profession. Several respondents called for licensing to be revamped, simplified, or made less bureaucratic. Kyle Schumann, Paul Preisner, Clark Denhouse, and Jimenez Lai all described how much work was involved in getting licensed.
There's so much knowledge embedded within the profession that there's an expectation basically that when you graduate from architecture school from an accredited degree, you're not ready to be an architect. You have to go through all these hoops and sort of this whole system that NCARP has laid out for you, right? And so there's so much knowledge there that comes in terms of how do I actually practice architecture? How do I engage with contractors? What are workflows specific to like the production of a building?
The professional practice of architecture in the United States is just horrible through almost every level. The kind of ridiculousness of the licensing process that seems more extensive than anywhere else, yet at the same time, every part seems to have no trust for other parts of it, right? Like your education apparently counts only so much as it allows you to then take an exam, which only so much allows you to supplement that with an enormous amount of internship at another office before the state feels comfortable licensing you, right? Which obviously puts pressures and excludes people from actually participating in architecture.
I do think that there are ways to rethink how examination is handled, to rethink how accreditation is handled, to rethink, and that actually has just undergone a change anyway, but also to rethink how the value of things like the AIA and how those things tend to, and this goes back maybe to the topic of authority, you know, those regulatory agencies tend to treat everything as a uniform block. It's like even the examinations, everybody's examined, it takes the same examination no matter if they're going to work on single family residential or towers, wherever. So those things treat things uniformly. And that tends, I think, to reduce the capacity for the kind of vitality and richness that is embedded in architectural discourse, but also the way that new voices and new audiences can come in.
I don't want to pin everything to the ARE or the NCARB or, you know, these kinds of weird associations that, you know, hold the gatekeeper position. In what ways do you submit what bureaucratic language so that who approves your building sets? It reads like hieroglyphics if you're suddenly dropped into that deep end of the pool. I'm working on it at the moment. But it's not going to happen overnight. It's just as much work as it is the teaching side of the work.
However, it is worth pushing back a bit on these characterizations. Passing 6 tests and logging the hundreds of hours that NCARB requires is by all accounts a challenge, but there are over 120,000 licensed architects in America. Another target of criticism in this generation was large firms. Specifically, this cohort saw 1,000-person multinational firms as unfairly competing for and winning small-scale public projects. These commissions, like branch libraries or post offices, would be hugely significant for a young designer, but just a drop in the bucket for a firm whose annual revenue is measured in the billions, like AECOM. But because of their wealth of experience, large firms frequently won these commissions, locking this generation out of potentially career-defining opportunities. Here are Paul Preisner, Stuart Hicks, Andrew Holder, and Michelle Chang.
Other countries seem to have interesting ways to support younger architects in that the kind of public works are really open to more open forms of competition or younger practices to participate in it. And it's often scaled with the size of a project. Just bizarre and maybe emblematic thing here in Chicago that there was this project that the city did. This is like 15 years ago for bus shelters in the downtown. And that's the type of project that absolutely a city should just give to younger practices looking for work. But instead, the city gave this project to AECOM, right? Like to do bus shelters. And there was another one for a real tiny library in Chinatown. And again, the type of project that cities should be using to explore new practices and really allow other people to participate in the construction of the world we're in. And instead, SOM got that project.
I see why a small firm can't grow in Chicago. And maybe it's not so local. But here, you have SOM, you have Gensler, you have giant firms that do small branch library projects to stay relevant. They do pavilions for the Chicago Biennial. They, you know, like, why are these firms taking up these projects that would propel a small practice right away? They're in the room for the kinds of things that small practices that could build them up. And it's not their fault. Like, I'm not, they want to do fun stuff. They've got young folks in their practice that want to do stuff, but it's really hard.
Larger practices have a lock on the pipeline, and they've been able to appeal, I think sometimes wrongly, to the idea that like scale of practice is equivalent to smoothness of architecture's entry to the market for sale. That somehow, like, if you have enough bodies in your firm, it will be easier to sell the unit in the condo tower.
In Houston, for example, Gensler will scoop up really small projects. Like, oh, there's a yoga studio. Someone like a corporate office will go for that project, which makes it like impossible. It's becoming quite competitive with larger offices in a way that I just think a lot of the bigger offices have become morselized into smaller teams. That also makes things a little bit more difficult to compete because you're kind of an unknown.
As Hicks and Chang both describe, larger firms are themselves composed of individuals with design ambitions of their own. Armed with institutional expertise and resources, they can simulate the design environment of a boutique firm without the financial precarity. Neron Turan sees students who embrace large firms instead of setting out on their own to do more experimental design work as a product of increasingly unaffordable higher education.
I actually think that the main reason is loans. The students, when they graduate, most of them come from, I mean, we have at Berkeley and in other schools as well, we have a very diverse student body, which I like. And when they graduate, some of them don't have the, you know, support from the family to be able to really go in and experiment. And they really have to pay back certain loans. And then that, the address then is a big firm where they can work. And then that becomes the cycle. And that becomes the majority.
The dominance of larger firms does raise the question of what makes these firms so successful compared to smaller, younger offices. Are they better designers? Or do they provide a more secure investment with their ability to draw on a well of experience and to show a track record of prior successful projects? The security a larger firm can offer is aligned with the risk aversion which permeates the construction industry. Construction is wildly expensive, and those who commission projects, whether they're private clients, developers, or the state, are all trying to manage risk in order to deliver construction that is on time and on budget. Clients large and small are unlikely to take a chance on a practice that is untested, and many respondents found scaling up difficult in a sector that is so anxious about its bottom line. As a result, jobs go to firms who can show they've done comparable work in the past. Here's Eric Herman, Ashley Bingham, Jerome Hafford, and Paul Preisner.
Fundamentally, the problem starts with real estate. So you have things like real estate investment trusts, which are these abstract, stock, faceless investment vehicles that come in and are extremely extractive about real estate. So there's going to be no tolerance for risk in any way. So like as Ashley said, you're only going to get the project if you've done 10 before. And that delivery is going to be predicated on being able to extract a certain amount of value out of the building, usually out of a very small duration, like within the first 5 years.
Really large commissions, public buildings, large-scale projects that happen in cities and localities around the U.S. And I think there's a real aversion to risk. There's no open call for public buildings in America. You know, we have Spanish colleagues, and in Spain, any public building, I don't know the specifics, but most public buildings there's an open call for architects. And lots of times, very young architects win those. There's not a kind of emphasis on, to design a theater in the U.S., you must have done 3 or 4 theaters previously. You know, again, we have this kind of risk aversion that I think is really tied to ideas of capital and who's funding projects.
the barriers to entry of building in this country. The risk mitigation has become so prevalent that unless you've already built something, it's hard to convince someone to risk millions of dollars for you to build something. So you get this chicken and the egg problem.
If you want to submit to the RFQ for a small school that might only cost $2 million or something like that, you'll need to show evidence of completed projects of similar or larger scale within the last 5 years, right? Which is just something that so few people even have ever been able to have their hands on, that they end up always being won by the same like corporatized firms.
While it is frustrating for young designers to not have access to exciting projects, it's understandable that clients are careful with their money. The larger narrative we've heard so far is that the connection between academia and practice, which allowed academics to enter into building practice, is breaking down. Historically, academia was a way to sidestep the more typical process of building up architectural knowledge and experience while working at a firm before you stepped out on your own. In the contemporary moment, a young architect who wants to build might be better served by pursuing a path through practice rather than an academic career. But this generation, unable to turn back the clock on their careers, was looking instead for alternatives to typical client-architect relationships. Self-funding a project, partnering with a larger firm, or working with communities were all discussed as ways that this cohort could find avenues to do meaningful architectural work. Jennifer Bonner's House Gables in Atlanta was a high-profile self-funded project that several respondents mentioned. However, as with practices which rely on family wealth to produce their work, self-funding a project requires a level of personal wealth that's just not accessible to everyone. Here are Kyle Reynolds and Ashley Bingham on House Gables.
That's a super interesting way to approach something, is to say, you know what, I'm just going to do it myself. And then like, look at all of the interest that it has generated from being able to produce that. I mean, I think, you know, that's an excellent example of the notion that like, there's some really great ideas embedded in the group that's kind of collected here. And then given the opportunity to produce them, it does build an audience for that work that can lead to other things.
Jennifer Bonner's House Gables is an amazing example of what an architect can do when there's a different relationship between that traditional architect-client relationship.
Another strategy was raised by Stuart Hicks, partnering with larger firms to have a hand in design but allow the professional infrastructure of a corporate partner to execute the project.
One track that we tried was partnering with larger firms, and that was an interesting thing. So we did some projects, some design work for like towers and for Google and stuff like that. So we did work that way by partnering with firms. That seemed like a way through.
Ashley Bingham and Jerome Hafford saw working with communities as a way to sidestep the typical model of having a singular wealthy client.
Our work is really often, we have collaborators who might be community members, like in our Chicago Biennial project. We had on-site collaborators who were also architects, but collaborated with community partners. And so it was a project that operated outside that typical client-architect relationship. And I think that was to the project's benefit, obviously. But it also made architecture that was accessible to more people in a public space, in a meaningful way of engaging an entire community, rather than engaging a kind of single client with the work.
For my practice, a lot of my built work has been, frankly, community-driven work being funded or co-funded by clientele who are not the global elite, who are the global marginalized, or at best, just regular folks or organizations with some money, but not a ton of money.
Our conversations around practice drifted into melancholy. The inability for this generation to produce the built work that they'd hoped for led to discussions about dwindling architectural agency, the irrelevance of the discipline to the public, and a growing sense that while architects are useful project managers, they were not respected for their aesthetic expertise or cultural perspective. Clients do defer to architects on questions of building code, specification, and material assemblies, but they come with personal taste regarding aesthetics, which frequently trumps the taste of architects. The subjectivity of aesthetic judgment and the power dynamic that structures the client-service provider relationship means architects have very limited power over what a project actually looks like. That leaves this generation, who have invested years of their career in developing disciplinary expertise, which is chiefly expressed through form and aesthetics, unable to realize their work in built form. Here are Jaffer Kolb, Clark Denhouse, and Anani Mark.
There's less and less room for architecture the way that we've learned about the field as a discipline at large. And I don't see that trend reversing. And where you seem to really be able to do architecture as an architect is basically for wealthy clients who want bespoke, you know, it's basically like we're all becoming Savile Row tailors. It's like fast fashion, pronto moda. Like, this is what architecture is now. And designers increasingly can only design for the ultra elite and the ultra wealthy. Is that a competent, secure practice? I mean, I don't want that to be my competent, secure practice. And this is like a fundamental tension. I don't want to only make bespoke suits for rich men. That's not the shape that I want my practice to take. But everything else seems to be falling through our fingers like sand. We're just losing building types over and over again within a kind of industrial production paradigm.
Anything with design, you know, the client feels perfectly comfortable to send you a Pinterest board or something. And a lot of times I really appreciate that. But the point is that there's a subjectivity to it, or they perceive it as that. But if you say like, oh no, structural engineer said this has to be here, like there's no debate. There's an objectivity because it's like math and structure. And to some extent, that's true. But there is a kind of subjectivity that seems to be that when it's design, you know, people have their Pinterest board and they have their whatever their magazines are. And like really what they sometimes need is need somebody to draw it.
So much that goes into construction is complicated. It's very complex. We do have to rely on the expertise of others. And that expertise goes beyond what we could, each one of us, know personally, right? So you end up surrounding yourself with an incredible number of other types of experts. So your role is diminished, I guess, other than somebody who makes those connections. The role of the architect, maybe this is some sort of 20th century profession that is very quickly now coming to an end, especially in the American context. I could imagine somebody from a manager's perspective saying that there's really no value for an architect to come in to hold all of these experts together. But we can imagine somebody else doing that job more effectively and more efficiently.
We will end with this question of the value of architecture, or the value that architects bring to a project, or even more specifically, the value that this generation of progressive academic architects bring to the built environment. This cohort's expertise is their aesthetic, formal, and cultural knowledge of architecture, more so than their project management skill or experience with construction. But they saw their disciplinary expertise as no longer respected or even needed. Meredith Miller saw the role of the architect as increasingly precarious in a culture where architectural production has become the responsibility of groups of experts and put in service of profit.
Buildings are going to continue to happen because buildings are needed. Whether or not architects are a part of that is an open question. You know, there are going to be different configurations of professionals and capital and material and labor that are going to be ushered toward building. Whether or not architecture as we know it, the kind of discipline of architecture, is going to play a kind of important role in that in the future, I think is a question. And I'm not sure if that has to do with our lack of training as business people. I don't know if it has to do with maybe a kind of conflict between what our ambitions are, or what we kind of expect our ambitions should be when we're coming out of school and then we start practicing, you know, and there's a kind of conflict between the reality of practice and maybe what people expect of practice. I'm not sure where it's coming from, but, and I don't think that this is true of everyone. I think there's still successful architecture practices out there, but I think that it doesn't seem like architecture is, I'm trying to put this in not such a negative way, but I don't think the public sees architecture as a essential service or as like a high art. And so what is it then? And I fear that it's just becoming a kind of luxury commodity, and it's this kind of extra expense, a kind of extra layer of added value for those that can afford it. And maybe that means it's important for us as architects to find ways to assert architecture's value in a way that's not limited to that kind of like luxury market.
How this generation will navigate the shifting cultural relevance of the architect remains to be seen. But even in the time between the interviews and the editing of this series, this generation has produced a meaningful collection of built work. Meredith Miller, Jaffer Kolb, Jimenez Lai, Michael Meredith, Niran Taran, Anna Niemark, David Eskenazi, and Clark Denhouse have all completed ground-up residential projects. I will continue this discussion of practice and the way that the political economy of architecture structures this generation's output in the next and final episode, which is my conclusion. I will offer some concluding editorial thoughts on this issue of attention, primarily by situating this generation within discourses of labor. Thanks so much for listening. You have been listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture. Issue 8, Talking About My Generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. The editing and production was by Tim Cox. Narration was written by Tim Cox. Thanks to the Graham Foundation for Advanced Studies in the Fine Arts for their generous support. And thank you for listening.